This is November 1st, 2015. And I'm going to talk this morning about exile and awe. We've seen this daily, weekly earthquake of humanity, moving flood, more like it, flood of humanity, moving through European countries, migrants fleeing intolerable, hellish suffering in Syria and Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, for months now. And when it was really something that you would see in every form of media, television, newspapers, online magazines, it seemed to crest, that is, the coverage of it. There are those who say it's going to get much worse, but the coverage of it reached a crest, from what I can tell, a couple months ago. And there was an article that caught my eye in the New York Times. It's a column, sort of a column about philosophy in the broad sense. Philosophy in the broad sense means a search for truth. A philosopher is one who is searching for truth. In that respect, we could say that anyone in spiritual practice is a philosopher. It's not the way we usually use the word, but the column is about philosophy in that broad sense. It's called The Stone. And this article is by a Kostika Bradatan, who's an associate professor at Texas Tech University and the author of Dying for Ideas: The Dangerous Lives of the Philosophers. The name they gave the article is The Wisdom of the Exile. And it starts off talking about the tango. At one point in its history, the tango was popular in the world of Buenos Aires brothels. Toward the end of the 19th century, young immigrants, single, male, working class, who had come to Argentina to try their luck, would seek comfort in the drink, entertainment, and female companionship there. Argentines as distinguished as Jorge Luis Borges have insisted that the tango was born in these brothels. Others vehemently deny it. But the fact remains that the tango has preserved something of the anguish of the young and uprooted who danced it there. Theirs is quite a performance. These men we see panting on the dance floor are not some ordinary youths seeking to entertain themselves. They're people who have gone through the meat grinder of uprooting and survived it. They've come as close to death as one can without dying. It seems that the memory of a personal catastrophe followed by a miraculous survival has somehow remained inscribed in the dance's movements. Part of what makes the tango so erotically charged is that death is always so close at hand. To this day, the tango has carried with it this uncanny mix of vulnerability and strength. You can see now, think of these hundreds of thousands of migrants setting sail in rickety boats, over full with people hanging off the sides into the Mediterranean or these other seas near around Italy and Greece, or going overland, being met with sometimes with hostility and terrible, terrible tribulations. Then he gets into the real gist of this article. There are many types of uprooting. The brutal expulsions like those now devastating hundreds of thousands in countries like Iraq and Syria are common in the cycles of politics and war. Well, it's not that common. Maybe big cycles, but I've heard this referred to as the biggest crisis of the 21st century, the biggest since the mass see the floods of displaced people after World War, during and after World War II. But it can be more subtly political too, as was Dante's banishment from Florence at the hands of the Black Guelphs, or economic, as it was for the immigrants dancing in the Argentine brothels. Each person who survives this uprooting and finds himself in exile experiences an existential earthquake of sorts. Everything turns upside down. All certitudes are shattered. The world around you ceases to be that solid, reliable presence in which you used to feel comfortable and turns into a ruin, cold and foreign. And then he quotes Dante in Paradiso, "You shall leave everything you love most. This is the arrow that the bow of exile shoots first." I have to commend the Germans and of those other European countries that are taking in so many tens of thousands of migrants, knowing of what a huge impact it's going to have on their own citizens. I read last night that the New York Times focused on a little town in Germany of 102 people who are about to receive 752 immigrants. Such a terrible dilemma these host countries face. They can't turn away people who are in such desperate straits, and they can't accept them without possibly awful consequences, the strain on the social system, the inevitable unemployment spiking and all the social unrest that comes from unemployment, the crime, the violence, not to mention the possibility of these fanatical jihadis slipping in to wreak havoc in their host countries. In a way, I won't say a no-win situation, because there is the possibility of tremendous fertilization of the host country with all this new diversity and eager people, eager to work, and possibly, at best, creativity that will give an infusion of new life in these host countries. That's what we would hope for. But there could be decades of consequences of them accepting all these people. And especially the way Germany, let's say it for what it is, after terrible things that happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s, to have this kind of rebirth where, contrary to common sense, without knowing how this will, they'll be able to accommodate these hordes of people, still accepting them. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be big problems up the road with that welcoming turning hostile, but at least having that kind of openness to people who are in such unspeakably terrible circumstances. I remember in the Zen merging of East and West, one of Roshi Kaplow's the first one was the three pillars, and then the wheel of life and death, and then the other one, the next big one, was Zen merging of East and West. And in there, in his autobiographical account, he talks about how struck he was when he reached Japan after the war, of how different their attitude was than the Germans. He describes how in 1945, 1946, 1947, Germany, there was so much self-pity and self-justification and defensiveness among the Germans. Whereas in Japan, he said, there was this acceptance of their terrible defeat as karma that they had sown themselves. He was very moved by this. This is one of the things that impressed him so much about the culture out of which Zen grew. But I'd be sure that he would have a very different take on it now that we see this tremendous level of denial on the part of the Japanese about their terrible past with the rape of Nanking and the so-called comfort women of Korea, and how the revisionist history that goes on there, and there's still their refusal to acknowledge it. And whereas in Germany there is this wonderful kind of change that's happened, as we see with this, the reception of these migrants and many other ways. It's a new Germany. It's a new, complete new national identity. Every country will have its extremists, its neo-Nazis or others, but it's quite an amazing change has happened. But back to the article. The author says, from Ovid to Dante to Czesław Miłosz, exile has been portrayed as a catastrophic event. And it is. If such an uprooting comes to the exile as a form of death, it is not just his own death, but that of the world that dies with him and in him. To live is to sink roots. Life is possible only to the extent that you find a place hospitable enough to receive you and allow you to settle down. What follows is a sort of symbiosis. Just as you grow into the world grows into you. Not only do you occupy a certain place, but that place in turn occupies you. Its culture shapes the way you see the world. Its language informs the way you think. Its customs structure you as a social being. Who you ultimately are is determined to an important degree by the vast web of entanglements of home. Of course, it's always a mutual interaction of and something new emerging. Of course, it's not just the migrant who is being changed. He continues, uprooting is a devastating blow because you have to separate yourself overnight from something that, for as long as you can remember, has been an important part of your identity. In a sense, you are your culture, customs, language, country, your family, your lovers. This is Buddhist in a sense that that there is no separate self. Each one of us is a web of relationships. We are formed, we're determined by our relations. All of these things, our culture, our customs, language, country, family, lovers. Yet exile, should you survive it, can be the greatest of philosophical gifts, a blessing in disguise. In fact, philosophers too should be uprooted at least once in their lives. They should be exiled, displaced, deported. That should be part of their training. For when your old world goes down, it also takes with it all your assumptions, commonplaces, prejudices, and preconceived ideas. To live is to envelop yourself in an increasingly thicker veil of familiarity that blinds you to what's under your nose. The more comfortable you feel in the world, the blunter the instruments with which you approach it. Because everything has become so evident, you've stopped seeing anything. Exile gives you a chance to break free. All that heavy luggage of old truths, in quotation marks, of old truths, which seem so only because they were so familiar, is to be left behind. Exiles always travel light. The redeeming thing about exile is that when your old world has vanished, you are suddenly given the chance to experience another. At the very moment when you lose everything, you gain something else, new eyes. There's a few words by Marcel Proust. The true journey of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having fresh eyes. That's what practice offers us. Aside from whatever new landscapes we may see, it will always give us a new perspective on the what was the old and familiar. Indeed, what you eventually get is not just a new world, but something philosophically more consequential, the insight that the world does not simply exist, but it is something you can dismantle and piece together again, something you can play with, construct, reconstruct, and deconstruct. As an exile, you learn that the world is a story that can be told in many different ways. Certainly you can find that in books, but there is no deeper knowledge than the one that comes mixed with blood and tears, the knowledge that comes from uprooting. What really caught my eye about this article when I first read it was how we can reach much of the same sense of uprooting in practice. Certainly in Sesshin. Sesshin is, we are uprooted. We take very little with us to Sesshin. Everything about Sesshin is designed to deconstruct our mental attachments and our clinging to the known and familiar, what we think we know, and what is familiar to us. What a wonderful good karma we have that we don't have to suffer the life-threatening horrors of traveling across seas and through storms and through over mountains and everything else in order to experience this kind of letting go of being thrown out of our comfort zone into this world of silence. Going to Sesshin, we have to let go of this, of our knowledge, our ideas, the known and familiar. Or we have to, if we want to really experience the real promise of Sesshin. If we cling to any of that, if we cling to our expectations, which are ideas, if we cling to our expectations, then we will suffer in Sesshin to some degree. Nothing like what we see happening, playing out in Europe and those places now. But this is what we learn, is that to the degree that we can have the courage and the faith to let go of what we think of as ourselves, our self, the I, the me, and the my, to the degree that we can let go of that, then we will find ourselves traveling light and seeing with fresh eyes. One of the crucibles that some people face in going to Sesshin is just their just plain longing for their loved ones, just missing them, but deeply, having no way to contact them. This is why I feel it's so important in Sesshin to ban phones, smartphones, and other electronic devices, so there is a true uprooting. And Dante saying, "You shall leave everything you love most." This is why Sesshin is really a dry run for dying. It's dying without having to die. At its best, Sesshin fits the description by Shantideva, in which he says, "That which is not dear to me will not be. That which is dear to me will not be, and I will not be, and all will not be." The particular practice we work on in Sesshin, the koan or breath, it's all for the purpose of delivering us into exile. The koan is just that, a way of leveraging us, forcing us out of our grasping at the known and familiar, and being willing to venture into the darkness of what we don't know. Someone described as proceeding toward the obscure and unknown, through the still obscure and unknown. And it's not just Sesshin. Really, when you look closely, we have this possibility to experiment with exile every time we cross our legs, every day. If we can let go of our thoughts, if we can have the faith, there it is, the courage to break this habit of clinging to our thoughts, then even in the most ordinary day, never mind Sesshin, we can experience this freedom of no thought, no mind. I'll continue with this article. Exiles travel light because they barely exist. That's also Sesshin at its best. To the degree that we are free of thoughts, we'll be free of self. And that's another important lesson philosophers can learn from exile. Uprooting gives you the chance to create not only the world anew, but also your own self. As if they're different. Deprived of your old world, your old self is left existentially naked. It is not only worlds that can collapse and be rebuilt, but also selves. Selves can be remade from scratch, reassembled and refurbished. For they too are stories to be told in different ways. Often with uprooting, there also comes a change of languages, which makes the refashioning all the more fascinating. You can fashion yourself in very much the same way a writer fashions her characters. Well, they always go together, the world and the self. For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. And then Kostika, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, talks about Socrates. Socrates rarely left his native Athens, yet he fully understood the philosopher's need to practice uprooting if they are to do their job properly. Every time you hear the word philosophers, please think of practitioners in this context, Zen practitioners. He refashioned himself into a foreigner as a matter of philosophical method. As a recent biographer put it, Socrates claimed, quote, to be a foreigner in his own city, even to the extent of not speaking the Attic dialect. Not content with just taking an ironical distance from the Athenians, he deliberately uprooted himself from the city, cut off his ties, and burned his bridges. Socrates turned himself into an outsider in his own city, but didn't move to another. He became atypos, which meant out of place, but also disturbing and perplexing. Being atypos is crucial if you are to be a straight-talking philosopher, as Socrates was. There is in every community something that has to remain unsaid, unnamed, unuttered, and you signal your belonging to that community precisely by participating in the general silence. Revealing everything, telling all, is a foreigner's job, either because foreigners do not know the local cultural codes or because they are not bound to respect them, they can afford to be outspoken. To the extent, then, that philosophy is exposure of everything, especially of things no one wants to hear about, foreignness is highly necessary for its practice. The philosopher, at least the straight-talking kind, is bound to remain a metaphysical gypsy. Well, about the things no one wants to hear about, this is part of what Zen practice is, of course, is exposing not only the marvels and wonders of our true nature, but the dark sides of it, our shadows that we so stubbornly keep out of sight in our ordinary life, but then have the opportunity in Zazen. Even aside from Sesshin, in our Zazen, we have the opportunity to uncover these shadows and become whole by becoming aware of them, seeing them, and getting free of them. And in this reference here, where the article says, there is in every community something that has to remain unsaid, unnamed, unuttered. This is the realm we can reach in Zazen, and especially in Sesshin, where we're doing so much Zazen. The realm of the ineffable, that which is beyond words, beyond form. This is the realm of the formless. No mind, no thought. Socrates' case is telling. Like few others, he saw the philosopher's need to uproot himself from his own community, yet he refused to go into an actual exile himself, preferring instead a symbolic one. He lived in Athens as if he were a foreigner. This means that he practiced philosophy as a rather dangerous pursuit. Such a tightrope walking can never take you too far, especially when you, performing it with no safety net, make incessant fun of your audience. There is a Paul Bowles, an author who wrote a book on the Sahara Desert and what it can do to you and how it can change you. And I always read this as really something that would apply also to Sesshin or to the world of no thought, no self. This is what he says. The answer is that when one has been there and undergone the baptism of solitude, he can't help himself. Once he has been under the spell of the vast, luminous, silent country, no other place is quite strong enough for him. No other surroundings can provide the supremely satisfying sensation of existing in the midst of something that is absolute. He will go back, whatever the cost is in comfort and money, for the absolute has no price. Some of you may have heard that they're now doing research into to emotions that include awe, A-W-E. I first got onto this with a New York Times column someone passed to me. I'll just read it quickly. This is from March of this year by Gretchen Reynolds. It's a column called Well. Dark moods are bad for your health. Scientists have known for decades that a wide variety of unpleasant emotions like shame, depression, and anxiety are linked to greater rates of ills like heart disease, inflammation, cancer, and premature death. Conversely, positive feelings have been shown to be good for you. Far less is known, however, about the health benefits of specific upbeat moods. And then there's a new study that she reports on that suggests that one surprising emotion as a potent medicine, awe. And then she describes the experiment where 94 Berkeley students were recruited and they went through various positive and negative emotions, hostility, enthusiasm, inspiration. Then they supplied saliva samples, which were analyzed for interleukin-6, a molecule known to promote inflammation throughout the body. Inflammation is tied to poor health, and the researchers thought that'd be a good way of signaling good health or absence of it. They were They were tested on 7 specific emotions: awe, amusement, compassion, contentment, joy, love, and pride. And then it says, while happy moods were collectively still associated with low IL-6 levels, the strongest correlation was with awe. And maybe you can see where I'm going here, how when we are uprooted from the known and familiar, we can leave our comfort zones and leave our thoughts and notions and concepts and biases and prejudices and what we think we know, we find ourselves potentially in states of awe. Now, this article is from The Guardian, just from August of this year, and it's by Oliver Berkman. The other day, I got fairly decisively lost while hiking in the French Pyrenees. Not seriously lost, since I had a functioning iPhone and was never much more than an hour's walk from a road where, in a crisis, I could doubtless have flagged down a grudging French motorist. Is there any other kind? But just lost enough to feel the first frisson of something like fear, enough to be reminded that mountain ranges are very large and solid things, whereas I am tiny, a tiny and fragile thing, and that it takes a vanishingly small amount of effort on the part of a mountain range to kill a human. I say something like fear, incidentally, because the experience wasn't wholly unpleasant. The frisson had a distinctly pleasurable component. Actually, there's a word for this combination of terror, euphoria, and smallness in the face of vastness, which constitutes the oddest and least understood of emotions, awe. It's a wonderful description. Combination of terror, euphoria, and smallness in the face of vastness. He says, if you're anything like me, you probably don't need psychological research to convince you that you need more awe in your life. A trip to Yosemite or the Sheep's Head Peninsula or merely watching the BBC's Planet Earth or the Cave of Forgotten Dreams ought to do the trick. But here's some psychological research for you anyway. According to work recently published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, feeling awe in the face of overwhelming natural environments is associated with more pro-social behaviors of generosity and kindness. And then it describes how one study, participants spent time looking upwards at high eucalyptus trees. They were more likely to help a researcher who had dropped some equipment than those who were looking at a building. In another, watching clips from Planet Earth, if you haven't seen this BBC production, it is absolutely, well, awe-inspiring. Watching clips from Planet Earth triggered more altruistic attitudes. And then he quotes Paul Piff as saying, by diminishing the emphasis on the individual self, awe may encourage people to forego strict self-interest to improve the welfare of others. So there it is again. Diminishing the emphasis on the individual self. Doing less dwelling in thoughts of ourself. Perhaps it's not surprising that awe has strange effects on us. After all, it's a pretty strange phenomenon. The late psychologist Paul Pearsall, who did much to campaign for its recognition as an additional official emotion, noted that awe cannot be categorized as wholly negative or positive. The mixture of the two is fundamental. Again, I think of Sesshin and Zazen. Relatedly, it isn't provoked only by experiences we'd categorize as positive. Glorious natural scenes prompt awe, but so can the recognition of mortality brought about by the diagnosis of a potentially fatal disease. Crucially, in the new study, pro-social attitudes were associated with awe felt in the presence of natural beauty and natural disasters. Both are vivid reminders of the smallness of the individual self. We could say the falseness of the individual self. Pearsall also coined my favorite neologism, openture, as the opposite of closure, a mindset of actively welcoming awe, of being committed to fully experiencing everything that can be experienced, not just life's good bits. He even writes of experiencing awe and of feeling more alive than I've ever felt after discovering the body of his adult son who had killed himself. And then he talks about his ambivalence about the burgeoning psychological research on awe. He says, I can't help but feel a tension between awe itself, predicated on humility in the face of ungraspable vastness, and the attempt to pin that vastness down, to render it tame by understanding it. And this is what anyone who practices Zen long enough will realize, is that the deepest, most life-changing experiences are the hardest to describe. I'm going to close with a testimony from an astronaut, one of the Apollo astronauts, Edgar Mitchell, who described his experience on returning to the Earth. By the way, I first heard about him in Mexico. He was there studying these mountains, these mysterious, powerful mountains where Roshi and Polly and I used to go to work on Roshi's books. And he was there. He had gone there. After coming down from this trip you're going to hear about, he quit the astronaut program to open an institute for psychic research. But this is what he said after this trip. It wasn't until after we had made rendezvous with our friend, fellow astronaut Stu Rusa, in the Kitty Hawk command module, and were hurtling earthward at several miles per second, that I had time to relax in the weightlessness, there's also Sashin at its best, weightlessness, and contemplate that blue, jewel-like home planet suspended in the velvety blackness from which we had come. What I saw out the window was all I had ever known, all I had ever loved and hated, longed for, all that I once thought had ever been and ever would be. It was all there, suspended in the cosmos and that fragile little sphere. I experienced a grand epiphany accompanied by exhilaration, an event I would later refer to in terms that could not be more foreign to my upbringing in West Texas and later New Mexico. From that moment on, my life was irrevocably altered. You know, and consider what more complete exile could there be than going to outer space. What I experienced during that 3-day trip home was nothing short of an overwhelming sense of universal connectedness. I actually felt what has been described as an ecstasy of unity. It occurred to me that the molecules of my body and the molecules of the spacecraft itself were manufactured long ago in the furnace of one of the ancient stars that burned in the heavens about me. And there was the sense that our presence as space travelers and the existence of the universe itself was not accidental, but there was an intelligent process at work. I perceived the universe as in some way conscious. The thought was so large it seemed at the time inexpressible, and to a large degree it still is. He experienced the universe as in some way conscious because the universe is not apart from his own self. It's his own mind. But the ultimate exile is death, which offers the same promise of new life, new eyes, new perspective. The bardo is the Tibetan word for any transition. Really, any transition is a kind of a bardo. And in such an uprooting, in such an exile, we can face, again, as they say here, fear, disorientation, confusion. Back to Sashin, back to Zazen. It's not for the faint of heart. We always run the risk of exposing fear. But then by letting go completely into this this unknown, this exile, we have the possibility of experiencing this awe that is priceless, that can change our lives. Sashin at its best is dying. Zazen in the morning before going to work at its best is dying. That's the exile we have right within our reach every day, every minute. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.